Hi, Yoko.
Hi, Kate.
This is episode 19 of So Where Are You From?
Hey!
Hey! Hey! Hey! Hey! Hey! Hey!
We really need to get that guy Sung Lee to do that for us, because he seems great. Anyway.
Beatboxery.
Past model minority Sung Lee. Anyway. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm gearing up for... I'm just A-okay. I'm gearing up for a trip to Japan on Thursday.
Right.
I'm so excited!
I'm gonna miss you so much!
I need to get out of here.
Okay, I understand.
It's okay. I'll keep you in the loop of my Instagram
stories. Tell me your itinerary, Kate.
So we're going to Tokyo to visit my mom and I. Mom and I are going to Tokyo to visit my brother. He's been teaching English in Japan for the last 2 years. Oh, God. And I haven't seen him since he moved. But, yeah, I'd like to see him in his natural habitat, and, yeah, I want him to show me all the cool hip spots where all the young people hang out. I'm real excited to try the hot new restaurants.
And learn all the cool new lingo.
Oh, right?
It's changing constantly.
In all honesty, the thing that I'm looking forward to most is, like, observing the style of young Japanese people in Tokyo. Oh, my God. They're just so trendy. So trendy. Oh, I can't wait.
Oh, man.
And then I'm going to eat. I'm just going to eat everything.
Please do.
Eat everything.
Yeah.
Take a lot of pictures.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Aw. So
yeah.
Exciting.
Going back to the motherland, recharging my batteries. Oh, man. Okay, so something that I'm low-key a little worried about is, so I think my mom and I are planning on staying at a ryokan. So, like, mm-hmm. after we go to Tokyo, we're going to Kyoto, and then we're also going to this place called Kumano, and we're doing the Kumano Kodo, which is mm-hmm. a mm-hmm. UNESCO World Heritage mm-hmm. walk. My mom and I are going on a walk. A really long one.
A long one.
Apparently, like, Buddhist monks did it before becoming Buddhist monks. It's, like... real beautiful, lots of trees, real dark, according to Yoko's mom. but I'm real excited about it. But the ryokan thing worries me because I have a tattoo.
Yep, I knew it.
I haven't been to Japan since getting it. And you are not allowed to go in the onsen, the bath, if you have
a tattoo. Does it say that explicitly? Because some places are okay about that.
Some places are okay with it. I don't know. I just feel like the unwritten rule is don't do that.
I'm just going to have to wear a Band-Aid on top.
I know. I think I'm going to do like a big sarompas. Like a...
Oh, yeah. That's smart. Mm-hmm.
So a sarompas is like a sticky, big sticky Band-Aid that's about the size of a postcard.
It's like an Icy Hot.
Yeah. It's like Icy Hot. Smells like Bengay, Tiger Balm, all those things with like menthol in it. And you just like put it on parts of your body that are sore. So I'm like, oh my God. I just played volleyball and my shoulder's real sore. Or, I don't know, I'm going to try, like...
I've been on my computer for, like, 13 hours today and my shoulder's hurt.
Exactly. And just people will be like, yeah. Either that or maybe I'll just, like, keep a towel, like, over my shoulder.
I mean, that is... you can do that, too.
Or I've thought about so many different scenarios. I'm like, okay, do I just wear a whole bunch of cover up and just don't wash my shoulder? Like, have a dirty ass shoulder by the end of the trip.
Do you only have one tattoo?
Just
right
one.
Now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, that is the biggest, not
deterrent.
The biggest deterrent, but all of the deterrents I have against getting my first tattoo is related to Japanese stuff.
Getting in the onsen.
Getting in the onsen. How, like, tattoos are very, like, associated with gang activity and just, like, my grandma probably being not happy about it. Like, everything, all of my doubts about getting a tattoo are related to being Japanese.
Word.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. Like, I'll figure it out. It might not be, I'm not 100% sure because I have to call my mom and, like, sync up on the exact itinerary. Mm-hmm. So if it's, like, a big group onsen thing, then yes, I definitely need to cover it up. Mm-hmm. But if it's just, like... an onsen that's, like, semi-private, then mm-hmm. and it's just me and my mom, then it doesn't matter. Yeah.
There are places, when I went to Kumamoto, there are places that you can, like, rent, like, an onsen room.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really cool, because, like, I don't know, it's, like, your own private bath.
Right.
It's, like, the one that we did had like a bath on the inside, and then there was like a door mm-hmm. that went out.
Yep.
There was an outside. Oh my God, it was so cool. And it was like raining. It was sick.
It's kind of nice being naked outside in like a protected area.
Yeah. I wonder if, there was something like really refreshing about that.
Yeah. But anyway. I have to wonder though if someone's going to see it and like freak out or report it or like what would happen.
Honestly, I think the worst thing that's going to happen is like someone's going to come up to you and be like, I'm really sorry, but you can't be in here.
Right, probably.
Which sucks, but yeah, I don't think anyone's going to like call the cops on you.
I know, right? Well, I'll report back.
Please do.
In 10 days.
Oh my gosh.
I know. I haven't been to Japan in like 3 years, so I'm sure stuff's different. Mm-hmm. Things have probably changed. Stuff. Things aren't where I left them.
You'd think that time would stop when you leave a place. It does not.
It doesn't. It doesn't. How about you, Yoko? How are you?
I'm well. I'm busy with work. Mm-hmm. I'm getting back into dance class. Mm-hmm. I think for a while I was having trouble getting into the rhythm of taking dance class.
Into the rhythm?
Yeah, you're right.
Die alone.
No, you're not. That's why I love you. Oh, not because you're going to die alone, because you make weird jokes.
Oh, God.
It's been, I don't know, aside from that, I'm just like, I'm feeling the need to like walk outside more. And now that the weather is getting nicer, it's just like I'm getting really anxious to just be like walking around.
Yeah.
Outside mm-hmm. in the sun without my stupid coat on. Oh, I'm so tired of wearing my winter coat.
I know. I have like 2 coats that I wear and I'm just so over them. I'm like, is it a waterproof coat day or is it a poofy coat day? You know what day it is? A no coat day.
Yeah.
Today I wore my jean jacket.
Yeah, I wore my leather jacket today. I have like 2 weeks to wear that leather jacket. I'm wearing the shit out of that jacket. Yeah, my winter coat, I only have one. You know when you go into a restaurant and it like smells like food in there and you leave with your coat smelling like food?
Did you get Korean barbecue recently?
No, it's just like there are some restaurants that just like you leave and you smell like oil. I hate that smell, and it's like on my coat. My winter coat that I've had to wear because it's cold. Can't take it to clean it because then you don't have a fucking coat. Yeah. I just smell it all the time. It's so annoying. Ugh. Anyway, I mean, it's so, like, not that big of a deal, I guess.
The end is near.
The end is near. I can't wait to put that thing in dry cleaning and then just not look at it until October.
Seriously. Do you want to do model minorities?
Yeah.
Do you want to go first?
Okay. So my model minority is a young woman named Helen Lay. Kevin and I came upon her YouTube channel just like completely by accident because we were trying to look up, I can't remember what it was, but we were trying to find how to cook a certain Vietnamese food. Mm-hmm. And we were just like, searching for the food. And then this woman's channel comes up and she's just like a young woman who doesn't live in Vietnam anymore. I think she lives in Germany. Mm-hmm. And she's been like, she's making YouTube videos of like how to cook Vietnamese food. And it's just like, some of her early videos are super low production. Like, you can see the progression of her, like, starting this little channel. And eventually she, like, becomes, like, a food ambassador and, like, gets flown to Japan.
Nice.
And like, gets to, like, do a video blog about what it's like to eat there. And, like, she meets people there. And it's just so cool to see, like, a woman just like starting this really small thing that like is really important to her, and it like takes off and she's like has like a book coming mm-hmm. out. I was just like, so neat. And the like some of the original, like the old videos kind of reminded me of this podcast and how we're like, our first episodes are, the guests are great, the content is really good, but just like the production value is just
real
like
bad. Thank you so much for bearing with us.
Thanks, we've come a long way. Yeah, I still have a ways to go, but
not done learning.
Yeah, totally not done learning. She's just, yeah, I just loved watching her channel, and also she was teaching us how to make food, Vietnamese food. It was so legit and cool.
Do you watch other YouTube Asian food channels?
No, but I know you do.
Yo, dog. I am all up on those. Like,
you love that Just One Cookbook?
Just One Cookbook. Cooking with Dog. Japanese Cooking 101. Dog, yes. I think Cooking with Dog is probably my favorite one. And despite the name of the channel.
Oh, no. I didn't even think about that.
The dog is not in the dishes. The dog is merely a bystander. But that dog died recently.
Yeah, R.I.P. Francis. Pour one out for the homie. Oh, yeah. Cooking Francis. With Dog is like this older Japanese lady who cooks and her poodle sits beside her while she makes traditional Japanese dishes.
I love that.
Yes. But yeah, dang. More Asian YouTube food channels. Oh my God. That's how I've learned how to make all the Korean food, all the Japanese food that I need clarification on. It's so good.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Dang. Thanks, Helen Lay. Helen Lay recipes on YouTube. Kate, who's your model minority?
My model minority is a guy named Derek Watson. Do you know who Derek Watson is?
No.
So there have been a lot of headlines in the news recently that start with Hawaii judge who blocked the travel ban.
Oh. Yeah.
And Derek Watson is that guy. So, I mean, I can spot Hoppas a mile away. But I was just like, yo, this dude looks Hoppa. And it just says that he is of Native Hawaiian descent, which I'm a claim. I'm gonna claim him for us. But I'm so proud of him because he blocked Trump's travel ban.
Wow. So what is his position? Like, how do you block a travel ban set by the president?
See, that was the thing that I was like, need to get more research on.
Listeners, if you know, email us at swavepodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. It's basically like he had a 43-page ruling that like concluded that the new executive order failed to pass legal muster and the state established a strong likelihood of success on their claims of religious discrimination. Hmm. So I think it's basically the state filing like a suit against the government.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Hashtag legal muster.
Yeah.
Muster on the beat. Yes. Thanks, Derek Watson.
Thanks, Derek. You are the best. Oh, my God. Muster on the paint. Oh, that's amazing.
Also, thanks, DJ Mustard.
Yes.
For being... You know his real name is Dijon?
Yes, I do.
All right, cool.
Muster on the beat. Oh. Let's talk about our interview with One Rain No.
Yeah, yo, okay. Well, I realized we didn't talk about this, how Rain and I met.
Yeah, which why don't you tell us?
This is going to sound like a pattern because this also happened with Ken, but this is the last of my internet friends.
Yoko
I met Rain on the internet.
Dudes on the internet.
When I'm in like fucking high school.
High school
and
Yoko.
Like completely naive to the fact that the internet can be a place where I might get taken advantage of. But yeah, Rain was just a guy that I somehow found, like, on LiveJournal. I think it first started out with me finding this parody Kim Jong-il LiveJournal account, where it's basically, if you imagine, like, Kim Jong-il chatting on AOL Instant Messenger with, like, other world leaders, it's, like, screenshots of those conversations. And it's just, I tried to pull it up and find it, but all of the images are, like, broken links now, which is really unfortunate, but it's just so funny. And then I think I found out that he is a guy living in New York, and somehow, I guess, as I later found out, he was interested in meeting with me because I wrote, like, a really emo blog post on LiveJournal about not getting into the colleges I wanted. Just so, like, embarrassing.
It's beautiful.
I don't know.
Blossoming friendship.
But yeah, Rain, yeah, we just, like, met on the internet and hung out a couple times and then have sort of kept in touch and like run into each other on the street and stuff. Yeah, he's just a really cool dude. Now he's a senior editor at Core 77, which is awesome.
Yeah, Core 77, for those of you who don't know, is like a really well-respected industrial design website.
If you don't know, now you know.
Mm-hmm.
You should know.
It's really interesting pieces.
I mean, I feel like I not grew up, but I feel like I got through my academic career like reading that blog. And then, yeah, I found out that he was a senior editor. I was like, cool.
I know that guy.
Yeah. Who? Anyway, yeah, he was really cool. And we recorded in his shop.
His
home?
Studio. Home?
Workshop?
Works,
home?
Work. Homes, homework studio.
Yeah, in Soho is huge.
It's huge.
Yeah.
It's like a warehouse.
Yeah, it kind of was like a warehouse.
Yeah. And he had two adorable Shiba Inus.
I know. Betsy and Kit.
They're so cute.
So cute. So, yeah, we'll get into that right now.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Yay. So, today on the podcast, we have Rain No, who is
I recently found out, a senior editor at Core 77, amongst a bunch of other things, which we'll probably get into. We're really excited, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Yay!
We just found out that Rain has listened to the entire podcastography.
I love them. The last one was my favorite.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, Brian. Oh,
it was great because he was like the super fan, and he knew when you guys had discussed stuff. He kept it moving, and he was great. Exactly.
He was really
just
great.
Like, nope, already talked about it.
Yeah, we'll just keep going.
Yep. All right, Rain, so where are you from?
So the answer would differ depending on who's asking. So rather than asking me as Kate, can you ask me as the bro at the rooftop party?
So bro, like where you from?
Yeah, I'm from a little area called None of Your Fucking Business.
Oh! That is the best answer I think I've ever heard.
That's the fantasy answer, right?
Right.
Yeah. I'm from a town called Go Fuck Yourself. That's what you want to say, right?
Oh my god. Oh, okay. Man.
If I'm answering you, obviously, it's different. I would give the honest answer. Sure. Born in Queens. Parents are Korean, but they emigrated to New York early and separately, which is, I think, unusual for most Koreans.
Oh, gosh. Were they married before they came
no,
over?
No. They met in New York.
Oh, cool.
So they had already assimilated because my dad landed in San Francisco. My mother landed in Louisiana. She went to LSU, took the bus up to New York. This is like in the 60s. Telling me like horror stories about like, you know, I got out of Port Authority. There's just pimps everywhere. And like, the first night she had to sleep in this hooker hotel because she didn't have money. And I'm like, Ma, I don't want to know. And then, yeah, she met my dad. They got married, had me. And then they made the odd decision, at the time, the odd decision, to raise my brother and I completely assimilated. This is like, I'm older than you guys. So this is the 60s when they met. And there weren't that many Koreans. And I think they had no notion that there was going to be, like, a Koreatown and, like, Koreans coming over in droves.
Right, because this predated all of that, right?
Totally. Mm-hmm. So we lived in this apartment building in Queens. All my neighbors are Jewish and Italian. Mm-hmm. My babysitter, Ruthie, this Jewish woman, you know. And then we moved to Staten Island, which is predominantly Italian. And then at the age of about 8, we moved up to the safe suburbs, Westchester.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Westchester.
And I had this total, like, culture shock. It was, like, total turnaround.
Sure.
I lived in a neighborhood in Staten Island where everybody names like Anthony and Christina. And then Westchester's like Alexander and Madeline, and you know.
Oh my gosh.
So the kids made fun of me mercilessly, not because I was Asian, because of my accent.
Oh, because you got like that city accent?
It was Staten Island. It was the work, you know, my mother, my brother, my father. Like, it was terrible.
What a.
I just remember them like mocking me, but.
Wow.
I think you have the most authentic New York accent I think I have ever heard.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a hybrid, though, because it's like you'll hear parts of Westchester and parts of Staten Island.
What does Westchester sound like?
I don't know if I can make it different for you. Ever watch Impractical Jokers?
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay. There's a guy in there with like the quintessential Staten Island accent. Westchester is a little bit more, it's a little bit less marble-mouthed. Gotcha. I don't want to say it's like an intelligent, educated New York accent, but it sounds different. But, oh, so anyway, Westchester, although the bulk of the kids were white, it was actually really multicultural when I think back on it. Because I remember, like, birthday parties and, like, photos. It'd be, like, me, a couple black kids, a couple other Asian kids, and then a bunch of white people. There was a lot of Jews, a lot of Italians. And I never had a single racial episode, like, growing up.
Really?
It's really crazy. Mm-hmm. Even, like, you know, arguments or, like, fights you get in high school, it was never racial. And actually, this is kind of embarrassing. I do remember one time. So my core group of friends in high school, there was like a super Aryan white guy named Lars Johansson. I mean, white hair, blonde, blue eyes. He was like from, he was Scandinavian, his heritage.
Yep.
My other friend Bill was black. And then there was a Jewish kid. And we all used to just rip on each other. guys do, you know? Like anything that you did, it made you look stupid. It's some shirt. You just mercilessly rip on each other. And one night we were doing this in the diner, and I ran out. And Lars was just, like, hammering me. And I was so desperate for, like, a comeback. I was like, now you just say that because I'm Oriental. Back then you would say Oriental. And he turned on me with such fucking savagery. I'll never forget. He was like, how fucking dare I don't give a fuck what you are. And he was, like, screaming at me.
Whoa.
And I knew that he was right, you know. Mm. And after that, I was like, oh, fuck.
You got reverse racism.
Yeah.
Or something.
Tried to pull a race card.
No, I tried to pull a race card, and he was like, I am not buying that bullshit.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So where in Queens? Just curious.
Oh, I was born in Elmhurst.
Oh, dang.
And then Arden Heights in Staten Island.
Wow.
And then Mount Kisco in Westchester. And then I didn't have any Asian identity. Even in college, I had no grasp of Asian anything. In college, I went to art school. I went to Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
A group, again, the friend group was like multicultural. A couple Chinese kids, a black guy, Italian guy, whatever. I was so ignorant that I didn't even understand that there was different Chinese dialects.
Oh.
I remember asking my friend, like, so do you speak Chinese? Like, I speak Cantonese. I'm like, I don't give a fuck if you speak Cantonese. You speak Chinese, I'm asking. You know, just like, I'm fucking ignorant. And then I had this friend, Omar, who was Filipino, but basically sounded black. He grew up in Virginia Beach. If you had him on the phone, you'd be like, this guy's like 6'2 and black. He's like my height and Filipino. But he was like, yo, Ray, you got to read, man. And he's like, did you know that they put Japanese people in internment camps? I'm like, get the fuck out of here. And they, holy shit, they did. He would like show me these things and like kind of educated me.
Totally. I barely learned about that in school. And I grew up in New York. And like my parents are also immigrants. So like nobody in my family experienced internment camps. So it was like really interesting to like move to California and also meet people who are from California. Kate's family is just like, yeah, that is a really important, not in a good way, part of like what I know in my family history.
Right.
Sure. At what age did you learn that about the internment camps?
I think it was around the same time that I even learned that there was a war.
Yeah. Okay.
To begin with.
All right.
The first time I was made to realize that something like that had happened was actually when I was in school in Japan for a summer. I was like visiting Japan. This must have been like third or fourth grade when everyone is learning about World War II.
Okay.
And I was actually perceived as the aggressor.
Wow.
So weird, right?
That's crazy.
So like for the longest time, like, yeah, that was totally the way I thought about it.
Yeah.
That's and
bugged out.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's an important historical lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
But also just like a really different perspective from what I know.
Yeah.
And what other people have had.
Mm-hmm.
It was weird to learn about because I was practically an adult. And it's like almost like shameful, you know? There was a kind of Asian turning point, I guess, my senior year. A woman named Phoebe Ang came to speak. And she was the publisher for this upstart magazine called A Magazine, along with Jeff Yang, whom you guys probably know. So she spoke in this lecture, and I went by just because I was bored. And there was only like three people there. It's just like a bunch of Asians. But what she was talking about was like Asian identity and like learning about history and politics and like we have to mobilize as a group and all this stuff I had never heard before. And I was like, I was really fascinated by it. So afterwards, I went up and I talked to her. And then she said, oh, well, you know, we have internships if you want to come by and like apply for one. And at the time, I was writing for the school paper. I scored the internship. I met Jeff Yang. It was great. He showed me like how to structure magazine articles. He liked my writing. He helped me. He hooked me up with like a freelance gig at Mademoiselle. Like he was just such a connected guy. But more importantly, he introduced me to the last batch of interns. And that's when I fell in with this clique of like these, you know, Asian intellectual, politically minded guys. A guy named Ken Lee, who now, damn it. Oh, he's going to get mad if I forget who he works with. Newsweek. Jesus Christ. And then his buddy Edmund Lee, who works for Bloomberg. And then those guys really kind of opened my mind and then also sort of brought me into their world. Ken would bring us back to his apartment in Brooklyn, which is like the hub. He lived in Sheepshead Bay. He'd grown up there. And, you know, I'd never seen like drugged out Asians. I'd never seen like raver Asians, like the whole like strata, you know.
Wow.
I probably got a little bit too militant and I burned a couple bridges as a result, which I'm always shamed about when I think about it.
Too militant where and in what context?
Just in my opinion and like when you learn things about like internment camps that are like really hard to swallow because I hadn't learned that at a younger age. So it's like more difficult to process. You're like, wait, I thought I knew America. I had this clear idea of what America was. I grew up in a very fair society.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how the fuck could this happen? You know? And then you start reading about like, I don't know, the Korean War and the Vietnam War. It's like, Korea, should we have been there? Vietnam, that's weird. It's like really shaky. Gulf of Tonkin and all that stuff. And the anger, I think, would come out in discussions with people that had nothing to do with it. You know, white friends that I totally alienated just by spouting off about things that they're like, dude, whatever. Like, I don't give a fuck. You know, that's not me.
Right,
So that, I guess the pendulum kind of swung too far.
I see.
And now it's gone back the other way.
Wow.
Can we talk about your getting your start as like a writer? What did you study at Pratt?
I studied industrial design.
Sure.
And then I did that corporate for about 12 years after Pratt. But prior to that, I had always written in high school. And actually, the only there were maybe three classes I took in high school out of everything that proved to be useful. It was creative writing, typing, and then auto shop.
Typing was a class?
We had typewriters back then. I'm old. This is the 80s. So, yeah, I still remember those classes. And if you fucked up, you had to, like, paint the little white, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
That's amazing. Wait, I have a memory of me being in high school, and I think this was you. You had a live journal.
That's right.
Where you took screenshots of AIM conversations between like political leaders. Was that you?
Yeah.
That was you.
What?
Holy cow. Okay, these are so fucking funny. Are they online still somewhere?
I'm not sure. I think LiveJournal is. I started a Kim Jong-il account. It was like the equivalent of Twitter back then. Yeah. It was like a Kim Jong-il AIM account.
Yeah.
And I would just fake conversations between him and other world leaders.
Him and like. Yeah. It was incredible. Just so funny.
And look where it's got me, Yoko.
Now you're talking.
Look at how far you've come. Yeah.
Let's go back to like how you started to write.
So in college, and I went to three colleges, but at the first one, which is like an awful white liberal arts school in the middle of nowhere, I was writing people's term papers for them. Like,
what? Dang, yeah, for money.
Is, yeah. I didn't have any morals, you know. that ended because I almost got one kid expelled.
Oh.
Because I accidentally, forgot to put one of the passages in quotes. You're supposed to footnote everything. Uh-huh. And because I didn't put the quotes, it looked like it was his original thought. But the teacher recognized the sentence from the document I had referenced. And then she almost expelled him for plagiarism. Yeah.
But it was meant to be a quote.
It was. I didn't put the quotes around it because I would write these term papers and go back and like add all the footnotes and. So I fucked up, basically. Yeah, he almost beat the shit out of me. And then I continued writing at Pratt. I got a job at the school paper. The A Magazine thing happens, and then Jeff Yang helps me get started. He hooked me up with my first freelance gig, and I was like, holy shit, because writing was something I did for fun or for $20 to buy buffalo wings when I'm writing a term paper. I'm like, you can actually get paid for this.
Right, yeah.
And Jeff had this network of other Asian American writers, and I almost feel guilty saying this, but like being Asian has been almost nothing but a plus for me. Like, I've never been, you know, chased through a parking lot or whatever. And, you know, it's always been like some professional opportunity has been handed to me as a result of Asian hookups. I don't know. I mean, we do have to eat a lot of shit as minorities, just little like daily interactions, right? But I think that the payoff is that there are enlightened organizations and people sincerely trying to help and make things better.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of Asians tend to take care of each other because you want to make sure that there are other people that look like you that continue to do what you do, right?
Totally. And there was one time, like, did you guys ever get called for jury duty?
Yes, but I've never served.
Okay. I actually love jury duty. I'm like the only person that, like, I'll show up on time
early.
Are
you the foreman
every
time?
Please pick me. No, never. But there was this one trial where, like, I found out that the guy being tried was Korean. I was like, I have to get on that jury because I don't care what he did. I'm going to hang that fucking jury.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Which is so wrong, but... But they do what's called jury selection, and I just remember the lawyer looking at me because they decide who's on the jury. And when she saw me, she was like, "No, I'm not putting the Asian guy in the jury because they don't want
Wait, but that's fucked up too.
I know, but they totally do it. Every trial you go to, they ask you all these questions because the two lawyers on opposite sides are trying to like determine who's going to be better for them.
Right.
Totally.
So they start like horse trading, and I'll take him, but then we got to get rid of her. And
so was the argument that like, oh, this guy's gonna set him free because he's also Asian.
I'm sure that's what she was thinking. She didn't actually say it. Mm-hmm. But I was looking her in the eye like, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I'm a fight for this guy.
That's right.
Like, I don't want you here.
Yeah.
It's funny because I feel like Brian was saying this, like the moment you introduce someone who's not white, that just like colors literally the, not literally, figuratively, mm-hmm. the perception that people have on you. Like if the defendant or the plaintiff were white, I don't think the lawyers are going to be like, let's not put any white people on this jury.
Yeah.
Right.
Because that's
right.
Going to be bad or good for the other people. And
absolutely.
It's so weird. But I love that you're just like, yeah, I'm definitely going to fight for this guy.
And to be fair, I'm half sure. It's like, I don't know if he murdered somebody. I just found out that he was being tried. And that was my instinct.
Right.
The Asian
totally.
Hookup. You
yeah.
Like, Samchun, I got you. In the jury box. Like, giving him a high five. The lawyer's trying to quiet me.
Can you talk about like your Korean identity? Do you speak any Korean at all?
No, so I speak negative Korean. If you speak Korean, like I'll take it away from you like a black hole. My parents, like I said, they wanted to raise us really assimilated, and I think part of it's because my dad had a really tough time when he first got here because he moved here with no family. All his family was dead. He was like totally alone, nobody to rely on. Mm-hmm. And his first job in Queens, he was a door-to-door salesman that didn't speak English.
Oh, God.
Yes, he was like, and I remember complaining about something stupid, and I'd be like a little kid, like, oh, there's no Captain Crunch, you know, oh, this is horrible. You know, he's like, you don't know what it's like to suffer until you don't speak any English and your job is to knock door-to-door trying to sell shit to white people that don't understand you. And like if you don't do it, you're gonna starve because there was no safety net for him.
Right.
Holy cow.
So I think him and my mother reached this idea that we're here now, you know, we left Korea because it sucks over there, we're not going back, so there's really no point in teaching him Korean. We have to raise like an American child that can succeed in this society. in later years, when Koreans flooded in, my parents are like, "Ah, oh, fuck!
Yeah. Why didn't we teach them anymore?"
Yeah, right. Oh, not that they were bitter that there were other Koreans, but remorseful that they didn't teach me so that I could fit in with that with the Koreans.
Sure. When did the big influx of Koreans kind of come into New York? When was that?
I don't know, because I wasn't around for. We were in Westchester all through the '80s. I didn't come back to Brooklyn until college.
You come back and you're like, where'd all these Koreans come from?
Yeah, and I'm like, holy fuck. Like, they're selling flowers, they're selling fruits and vegetables. Like, the entire, you know, all of New York was, all the fruit and vegetable people were Korean by then.
It's like, oh my God, 34th Street's all Korean.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. That kind of blew my mind. So, I don't know, because I was in Westchester for the bulk of my adolescence. And then I came back to Brooklyn and it had happened.
Okay.
And I remember trying to go to in college, like I said, I had no sense of racial identity, but I did pass the student union and there was like a big Korean event going on. I was like, well, I technically am Korean. Maybe I'll just go in and check it out. I walked in. It would have nothing to do with me. It was like when I walked in, like, needle stops, the music, everybody looks up.
You might be wondering how I got here. Well, I just saw the sign and I thought I'd come in. Yeah. Okay, bye.
No? Chang? No? Is that C-Take Chang? No? Okay. No, I'll leave.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's like they could just, like, detect it right away.
Completely. And also, I don't look Korean. I mean, I don't know if I do now because I've been boozing, so I'm getting like that Ted Kennedy square.
Oh,
but for most of my life, I've had like that narrower Japanese looking face. And it's weird because if you look at my parents, they look Korean. And then you look, my brother looks Korean. You look at me, it's like adopted. Like, and when I went to live in Japan, everyone thought that I was Japanese. Nobody thought I was Korean.
That's so cool. No one ever lived in Japan.
About a year.
Oh, wow. What? Why?
I was evading police in New York.
What?
No.
I would have totally believed that.
Yeah. Oh, now that I know you're gullible, all right, the second half of this podcast is going to be a lot more fun.
Yeah. Now I'm not going to believe anything you say. What brought you to actually live in Japan?
So,
and what part?
For work, for the design work, I was lucky enough to travel to Japan a couple times, and then I just fell in love with it. And I had been all around Europe, which I really liked, but that was my first real trip around Asia. I visited Taiwan, Japan, and Korea.
And this is design work for what?
I used to work for a designer named Karim Rashid,
Rashid?
That's right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So he was my professor at Pratt. Super nice guy. Everybody thinks he's a dick. Super nice guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he brought me there for an exhibit that I had assisted on some of the design work. And Tokyo was the first city. I was like, holy shit, because I'd been to a lot of major world capitals by that point. And I was like, Tokyo has all the good stuff of every city and none of the bad stuff. There's no crime, there's no dirt. You can eat off the subway platform.
Yeah.
It was polite. And I was like, I have to live here at some point. So then I applied to JET. Got in.
Taught English.
And I went, yeah, that's right. But it was tough because, like I said, I looked, I don't know if I look Japanese to you guys now, but back then I looked dead Japanese.
I'm really bad at telling.
I would have believed you if you had said you were Japanese.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But then again, you're gullible, so it's...
No!
I could have told you I was like, I don't know, West African. Like, really? Yeah, just really light skinned. I stay indoors a lot.
I feel like if an Asian person came up to me and just told me they were Japanese, I'd be like, okay.
I think it really depends. Like, if someone... I realize this is totally a microaggression as well, because when I tell people I'm Japanese, and they're like, you don't look Japanese at all. Like, it really kind of, like...
Yeah, that would
stings
me.
A little bit, right?
Is that a compliment or an insult? Like, I don't understand.
I don't know. Well, you know what I mean? Because it's just sort of like, there are positive things that you want to be associated with, and there's also negative things that you don't want to be associated with.
Sure.
But when it comes down to it, it's just sort of like, that is my ethnicity. So
right.
Just being told that you don't look the way that someone envisioned,
yeah,
I don't really know how to feel depending on what they're trying to imply.
It's also like, what is that information meant to convey?
Yeah.
Like, what am I supposed to do with that?
You're like,
thank you for telling me. You don't look like an asshole. But
you didn't look like an asshole, but now I know. Now I know you are one.
Yeah. But yeah, because everybody thought I was Japanese when I was living in Japan, I would walk in a restaurant and they would start speaking to me right away, and I would just like freeze up. Nobody could get their head around the fact that I was American from New York, you know? It was like shocking.
Yeah. That's weird. I feel like people just don't talk to me in Japanese when I go to... I mean, we've talked about this, but I just, like... I think both of us experience, like, not really being thought of as Japanese people.
I mean, I think people try...
By Japanese people.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I think I try to stay quiet for as long as possible, because as soon as I start talking, they're going to hear it. They'll be like, the accent's good, but a person wouldn't say that.
Yeah, sound like someone who's 60.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's how old my mom is as well.
Oh, the vocabulary is old from the old.
Well, we were talking.
Usually speaking old school. Like,
old school Japanese. Yeah, we were talking to Yoko's mom. And she used this word for rice cooker that I had never heard of. Or yakigama?
Yeah, I call it a denkigama, mm-hmm. but apparently that's like really, it's like old people say denkigama, and the new word is suihanki.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you guys are like, let's get in the horseless carriage and ride right. to the fair.
Like, and just like, oh, excuse me, do you mind if I stop by the lavatory?
And it's funny because like, not only do I speak like my parent, like people in their 60s or 70s, because that's how old my parents are. My parents, at the latest, moved to the United States in like 1980. So wow. They also don't have any context of like how Japanese people speak between 1980 and today.
Oh, wow.
So not just me, but my parents also probably sound kind of weird to mm-hmm. Japanese people.
It's sure. kind of like that movie Blast from the Past with Brendan Fraser. Mm-hmm. Basically, the movie is they think that the atomic bomb has been dropped because a plane crashes in their backyard. So they like stay underground until like all of their food like runs out from like the 60s. And then this guy like rises up in like the 90s and he thinks it's like the nuclear holocaust and everything's terrible. But he meets Alicia Silverstone and then figures out how to live.
Everyone's wearing neon and it's just like, it's much more brighter than I imagine this nuclear holocaust to be.
Yeah, he like rises up out from the bunker and it's like a grunge bar. So he's just like, oh God, But that's how I think my grandma probably feels when she goes back to Japan and starts hearing people, specifically young people, how they speak.
Right.
What language is this? Yeah. Not even the same.
Sure.
What has become of my beautiful language?
There was a really interesting article that I had read that was shared in one of our company's Slack channels. Mm-hmm. It was about how emojis are like ruining English or whatever. It's like the dumbest concept. But one thing that I thought was super interesting is that like if a language changes, it doesn't mean that it's dead. It means that it's more alive than ever.
Right.
And it's interesting that people perceive language as dying if it sounds different from the way they thought it's supposed to sound.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But yeah, I definitely feel like I'm super out of place. Going to Japan and just like talking to Japanese people, I'm just like, I know what the words mean, but like I have no idea what you're trying to say.
Well, I think you can also say that of 12-year-olds right now when you hear them talking and they're using abbreves for everything.
Yeah.
What? Really? Sure. I haven't spoken to a 12-year-old in like many, I don't know.
I was listening to some 12-year-olds on the bus today and it was horrifying.
Yeah. They're like, what?
It's like a different dialect almost.
It really is. Uh-huh. But anyways,
it's the future of our country.
I know. How has your writing kind of like evolved as you've been working in the industry?
You're talking about the professional stuff or the personal stuff?
Either. I'd actually be really interested in like your personal work, because I know your professional work writing for Core 77 is probably like a little bit more. It's like you're writing to a specific audience, right? But when you're writing for pleasure, like, what do you write about, and have you been kind of keeping track of your work over time?
Sure. So it's funny because when I was cleaning up this table, I had binders over there, like all the personal stuff, and I was just marveling at how like different it is between then and now. And it's just that now I've accumulated more experiences, and I feel like I can connect more dots. Now that I'm older, I'm able to see, I guess, patterns that I couldn't see when I was in the middle of them, or when I had not amassed enough life experience. Not that I'm like some wizened sage now. I mean, like at 20, I didn't know what the fuck I was doing, you know?
Sure. So do you mostly write fiction?
No, I feel like I don't have the imagination to generate compelling fiction, and I find real life so much more interesting. Even like when I read, I much prefer to read nonfiction, because it's like, holy shit, this really happened, you know?
Yeah.
I'm getting to the point where I'm almost running out of experiences.
So I've like, told all my cool stories.
Right. Every once in a while, I'll remember one, and it's weird because it's like I need to listen to music in order to write. I don't mean simultaneously, because I can't, if there's music on anywhere, I can't write. Uh-huh. But I need to walk around. Go out with the dogs. You just go for a walk for like an hour with the headphones and like music on random.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden I start remembering things, or like sometimes these really weird sentences will pop up as if like on a teleprompter. And I'm like, I have to get home and write this. It's almost like you're going to vomit. You have to get home and it just like comes out of you on the keyboard.
Wow.
But if I don't listen to music, like nothing happens up here. I don't know what it is.
And what music are you listening to?
It's totally random. I could show you my collection. Some of it's embarrassing.
What do we mean when we say embarrassing?
Like Creed embarrassing?
No. I lived in like a pop cultural black hole for like the past 20 years. Any new band, like I just don't know about them. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot of Motown, like old soul.
Oh, love it.
When I was a little kid, I found my mother had bought some records when she was still single. I remember one of them was like Greatest Hits of 1967. Oh. And at that point, I'd only heard like 70s, 80s music. I'm like, ooh, what's this about? And I'm like, holy shit, Aretha Franklin. This is awesome. Mm-hmm. Procol Harum. And then I went and I would track down these bands. I used to take the train down to the city. Do you remember Tower Records when it was on 4th?
Tower Records?
Yeah. So when I was living in Westchester, that was like the mecca because you couldn't find vinyl like of older stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know, vinyl's coming back right now.
I heard it is, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's definitely a warmer sound, but is it coming back by hipsters just trying to be ironic? Or is
yes.
It... Okay.
I mean, I was watching Vice News the other day, and basically Jack White has sort of like bought all of the available vinyl pressing machines.
Wow.
And is like trying to start like a mass production of them in Detroit.
It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And he said they're so hard to find, and he's like being an archaeologist and trying to dig up dinosaurs or something.
Sure. Do you think it really will come back?
I think so. I mean, my roommate and I have a record player at home. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, if you go into Urban Outfitters, like there's just always new vinyl up there. Like any new album that's like coming out is also coming out in vinyl, which I find really... really interesting and kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
But I think people are just have lived without like a tactile representation of things that they own for such a long time that the only way for that to come back is for them to have something that they can hold.
Sure.
Wow,
that's something I find fascinating, that need to have like something to physically manipulate, you know, because it's somehow digitally, it's like less satisfying.
Yeah. It is. Speaking of which, like so we're sitting in Rain's studio, home studio, and we're like literally surrounded by sewing machines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Vintage sewing machines that you refurbished, or like repaired on your own. Like,
how many did you say there were? 36?
I think 37.
37.
But that's counting the big, I got those like industrial machines.
Yeah.
Wow.
How do you like maintain both your creative writing and just like creating like physical objects?
I feel like I don't have any choice almost, but it's like because part of the sewing machine thing is a little embarrassing is because I hate dealing with people so much. I don't mean like you guys, but like going out in the world and having to meet new people or schmooze for work or something like,
oh my God, I know exactly how that feels.
Yeah. People are complicated. They're messy. When you fix a machine, like there's no gray area. It either works or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And like you can track down problems in a way that you can't with human beings. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, arguing with your girlfriend. We've been over this 1,000 times and this issue keeps coming back. Yes, I said it. No, I didn't mean it, you know. With a machine, it's like a lot more cut and dried. So I was doing that just kind of for to maintain mental sanity. And the way that I got into them in the first place is because of these two animals. I got these two dogs here.
They're two adorable Shiba Inus. Very well behaved.
They kept going through beds, and I kept buying beds, and I was like, well, fuck it, I can figure out how to make a bed. So I bought a sewing machine, and this guy said it was working, and that he had repaired it, and he lied.
Damn it.
Yeah, I had to figure out how to fix it, and I'm like, oh, this is fun. And then I was looking on Craigslist, and then there's this weird hoarding thing that takes over, but there's like a sewing machine like subculture of freaks like me who like cruise Craigslist like looking for like, you know, I need that 1953 Singer 1591 or whatever. Yeah.
I'm like looking at them trying to see if my mom's sewing machine is here.
Oh, so that's the story I wanted to tell you guys. There's a bunch of sewing machine forums online where people would discuss these different models. I'm having this problem, I'm having that problem. And there was this one woman who had this beautiful machine from, I think it was 1941. And she was saying, you know, I have this machine. And everybody's like, oh, great find. And people are like patting her on the back. And she's like, yeah, but like, look at this. And then she showed the manual, and written inside the manual, it said, property of Kyoko Matsuda. And she was basically saying, didn't Japanese people get like locked up and had all their possessions taken away?
Holy shit.
Like a little backstory. Mm-hmm. So back then, a sewing machine was like buying a car. It was super expensive. And the woman was talking about how well cared for the machine was, but that she felt kind of guilty because she felt certain that this machine had been taken from somebody.
Like repossessed.
Yeah.
Everyone had to give up everything before going to camp.
Right.
You could
exactly.
only take what you could carry.
Yeah. But I was, I was saying that it happened, but I was impressed because it was like this white lady who was like this older white lady, but I was like, wow, she actually knows about this shit, mm-hmm. brought it up and feels some remorse.
Did
that
she
impressed
track
me
her down?
More. What's that?
Did she track her down?
No.
Oh, gotcha.
No.
That would have been an interesting story of like trying
totally,
to return
right?
like a lost item to someone.
Although, how would you react if it was your grandmother's machine and then somebody came to you saying that they had found it?
I would freak out. I'd be like, why were you interested? Number one, how'd you find us? Number two, because my grandma has like zero internet presence whatsoever.
Sure.
But I think that would be really touching if someone felt like this belongs to your family and you should have it, you know?
Yeah. Wow, I'm going to write my name on everything. All of my shitty possessions.
Your world
I don't actually, own anything
world.
Of value.
That would be so interesting, though. It's like, okay, so one time I bought a skirt at a vintage store, and I met up with a friend who I hadn't seen in a while, and this skirt was probably from, like, the 80s, and we were both wearing the same one when we showed up to meet each other. Yeah, we were just like,
wow,
where did you get this? She's like, at a consignment store. I was like, I also got this at a consignment store.
How did that even happen?
Exactly. Yeah. It was so weird.
Was
so
one of you like, take it off?
I know, right? I was like, oh, we can't be here in the same outfit. God. But no, I just love things like that where like something old finds its way back to another person or like has a new life again. So yeah, write your name on all your shit.
Do you guys own a lot of things? Are you possessions people? Or?
Not really.
Not really. No, nothing that's like super, super precious to me at the moment. Like a lot of stuff that I have. Like if I was to like move tomorrow, I would be able to leave like 90% of my stuff.
Oh man, I so envy you guys.
What's like your most prized possession?
Like if there was a fire, what would I run in here to get?
Yeah.
To be honest, I could let all this stuff go. I feel this compulsion to collect it, which is why this looks like a hoarder's apartment. But
no, this is totally not a hoarder's apartment.
Really?
Yeah,
no,
this looks pretty
this is very neat.
Yeah, this looks neat to me.
I don't know. There's like 2,000 cardboard boxes in that corner, like filled with shit. I know this is bad pod. Nobody can see what we're talking about.
Just imagine it, listeners.
Yeah. I think the only thing I would really grab, obviously, besides the dogs, is the laptop or a hard drive that had writing on it that I wouldn't be able to recover otherwise.
Yeah.
But all this shit, I could find it again if I had to.
Do you think, so I'm a person who tries to minimize collecting things, so I don't really know what this is like. As a person who likes to collect things, do you find that it's easier to let things go because you would collect them again?
Totally. Totally.
Interesting.
Like, I can't get that attached to one of these machines because I'm like, Singer made millions of these. Like, let it go.
What would you, like, do you have something in your apartment right now that you would run to get if you...
That I would run to get
if there was a fire or something.
No, most of like my like sentimental value kind of things are at my parents' house. In LA.
Are they in a box?
Yes. Every time I go back, the box gets smaller and smaller.
That's
my mom
amazing.
Keeps telling me to clean it out.
Wait, why does it keep getting smaller? She throws them out, or?
Well, because right when I moved off to college, my mom wanted to remodel her house. And I was like, okay, cool. And she goes, put all your stuff in a box, and then it'll be here when you get back. Like, we're turning your room into, like, the guest room. Deal with it. And I was just like, okay, cool. So I put, like, all this stuff that I thought I would need or find valuable, and then I came home for the summer, and she was like, look through your three boxes and, you know, tell me if you still want this stuff. And, like, every time I went back, I was like, why did I save this? Why did I save this?
Okay.
Why did I save this?
So it was you. It wasn't like your mom was like, yeah, your yearbook, I burned it.
No. But it's so bizarre because whenever my mom calls me when she cleans out the house, she used to be, like, a huge hoarder. She used to love just, like, having stuff. And now she's, like, since she read that Marie Kondo book, she's been giving everything away. Everything's going in a plastic box. And so now she's kind of, like, meticulously cleaning, but every time she like asks me if I want to keep something, it's something that has no value. It's usually like childhood trinket and fat pants. Like,
that's great.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think because I grew up with someone that just had a lot of stuff all the time, that the thought of accumulating more is really kind of stressful for me.
That's really impressive. I'm awful at paring down the things from my childhood. If my mom heard your story about how your box gets smaller and smaller, she'll just be like, Yoko, why the fuck can't you do this? She's just like, I'm trying to work in your old room. Like, there's no space for me to do anything, so all your shit's still here. I mean, she wouldn't say all these cuss words, or she wouldn't say it in English at all, but...
What are the bulk of the objects?
There's just, like, there's a lot of, like, really random stuffed animals, papers from school, art projects, like...
I wish I had more papers from school.
Did you have art projects still? I feel like I have trouble like letting go of those, even though like you seem to have been able to let go of some of them.
Yeah, we got rid of like the real ugly ones, but my mom has my mom has like a couple good ones, and I'm glad that she went through them and she saved them in like laminated or not laminated, like those plastic folders.
Wow.
Yeah. So one time I was just like, hey mom, like I'm starting this podcast and it would really mean a lot to me if
by any chance did you come across my autograph photo of Michelle Kwan? And she was like, yes, I know exactly where it is.
Wow. It was like a librarian.
Exactly. That's amazing. And now it's hanging up in my room. So
that's so cool.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is value in keeping it.
Yeah. Hmm. I think I'm still incapable of
purging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why? What do you... Let's say that you came home and your mother actually didn't burn everything. Or
I think I would actually be okay.
Yeah.
I don't really care about my diplomas. They're still there.
Diploma is like a weird thing. Nobody's ever asked me to see it. It's like, why is it so precious?
You know? Right. Yeah. The only people who, I don't know, who like want to show their diplomas are like dentists.
Right.
Right. People who went to good schools.
In their office. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Rain, I have another question about being Asian. Were you ever the token Asian guy? Did you ever feel that way?
I don't think so. Let me think about that. Like, what kinds of situations would you... Like, what are some of the typical situations you envisioned?
I suppose it's just... I have a family friend who went to an all-white school and was used to being the Japanese guy. And he liked that role. And so whenever there's a big group of us kind of hanging out, I feel like he kind of takes, like, a little bit of a back seat or he doesn't talk as much. Whereas, like, I've seen him interact with his group of white friends and he's, like...
Interesting. He's used
confident.
To being the special one.
Yeah, I think so.
How funny. I don't think I've ever been in that situation, probably because I was so assimilated and I never felt particularly Asian because mm-hmm. I didn't have any constructed idea of race growing mm-hmm. up. But I do remember my first job in Long Island, I was at this design firm, and the office secretary, Cheryl, she's a very sweet woman, but she'd not grown up around people other than people that look like her. And I just remember, like, we would order lunch together, and when it came time to Chinese... And I'm not Chinese, but she would get the menu and not know what to order. And I could just see her eyes, like, going over to, like, look at me just, like, for some kind of, like, guidance. Like, and I want to be like, Cheryl, I didn't grow up eating Chinese. Like, you're going to have to take the fucking 47-1 black bean sauce. What the fuck do I know?
Just pick a number.
Yeah, yeah. That was the only time I felt like, wow, this person is focusing on me for that. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then my coworker, who was such a douchebag, This is part of what propelled me, I think, into that militant attitude, which I... held for a little while, which is the guy was so, he was this white guy, and the Chinese food would come, and I started eating with chopsticks. I knew how to use chopsticks, and he's like, why are you eating with chopsticks? I'm like, because we're eating Chinese food. He's like, well, I think that's stupid. We live in America. You should use a fork and knife.
What?
And I was like so shocked, and then like, he'd be like, why are you driving an Acura? And I'm like, because it's a good car. He's like, we're in America. You should drive a Dodge. He's like, shitty piece of shit Dodge.
God.
Like, he
that
had these like, back, yeah.
Dingus,
and
yeah.
I had to sit right next to him, and he was my senior.
Plus he's your boss. That sucks.
Yeah, well, he wasn't actually my boss, but he was like above
you.
Me. Yeah, so I quit after like 4 months.
Dang.
Well, that was a downer of a story.
No. I actually have a question about like writing and like kind of moving up in the ranks since you bring that up. What's like a piece of advice that you would give someone who's just starting their writing career? When you're a person who is pursuing a career in the arts, it's very hard to, you know, just kind of move up and kind of like keep motivation to keep doing it, especially when you get shot down all the time with something very creative like writing or...
Sure.
Yeah. And if you didn't feel like you studied it that much in school and you're like maybe starting out with less of a foundational knowledge, like you went to school for art, industrial design, so like maybe... Writing wasn't exactly in your purview when you were in school, but then eventually you kind of like got into writing and then now you're a senior editor.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I'm always afraid to give, I mean, I will give it, but I'm always afraid to give advice here because it's like whenever people have gotten to a certain position that other people might find desirable and they give advice, sometimes it's not helpful at all. Because when I was writing for the magazine, I went to interview this one movie star who will remain nameless, and mm-hmm. but she was like this drop-dead gorgeous... She'd won beauty contests, and that led to her movie career and all this. And her advice is like, oh, just do, you know, just follow your heart. Just do whatever you want, and things will just happen. Because it all happened accidentally for her because she was hot as nuts.
Right.
I mean, that was the basis of it, you know. So whatever I say is going to be colored by my own experiences. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you need to gain a level of competency in writing for the field that you're going to pursue. But beyond having the capability, you're going to need connections. Not people that are just going to be like, well, give them a job because I know them, but people that can introduce you to people through which you can then apply. Because there's just so many people out there. If you don't have some way to cut through the signal noise, you might never get your piece onto somebody's desk.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's easier to find those people if you are not well connected? Do you think it's easier to find those people now than it might have been
couple of years ago without the internet?
Yeah, basically before internet times.
I don't know, because it's like a double-edged sword, because it means that it's easier to find them, but then it means it's easier for the other 1,000 people who want the job to find them too.
Yeah.
So it's like if I had wanted to pursue freelance writing, Jeff Yang had this Rolodex, I'm sure he would have helped me out, you know. Mm-hmm. I just happened to veer off into design, and then I came back to writing at Core, But the only reason I'm the senior editor now at Core is because I've been there so long. I started writing for them in the 90s before we knew what a blog was. We didn't even know what to call it. We'll call it News Bits. That'll catch on. And it didn't. But just through attrition, senior people would leave. I would move up.
Sure.
So
I feel like this is a good time to transition into our segment.
How Asian are you?
I'm going to fail this.
I feel like we introduce this in a way that makes people think that they're about to like fail something.
Oh yeah, this isn't like an assessment. This is just a
maybe we should rename it.
Hmm. Anyway,
maybe next episode.
right now it's called How Asian Are You. So, question: do you hold your chopsticks correctly?
I think so. Should I don't have any here. Yeah, I do. It looks like the little drawing on the back.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Nice. Can you also can you manipulate those like metal? The Korean chopsticks, like the metal flat ones.
I freaking
like,
hate those. You know why they use them, right?
So
you guys know that myth about the silver and the poison and all that?
No.
So Koreans, I'm sure most Asian cultures do, they always emulate the royalty. And apparently it was thought that chopsticks made out of silver would turn black if they touched poison. And because in Korea, a lot of kings happen to be poisoned, during assassinations and such. Supposedly the king had silver chopsticks, so of course all the plebes are like, oh, well, I want silver chopsticks too. But yeah, those chopsticks suck. They're like all heavy and flat.
Do you know anyone who, like, why are they flat? So they don't roll away?
I don't know.
Like, I'm not expecting you to know the answer, but maybe...
I know. I've had round ones and flat ones that were metal.
Metal is, it's the flatness that I can't...
Yeah,
I don't know anyone who is able to manipulate those chopsticks.
It's very unergonomic, right?
Yeah.
I just feel like you're made to like flatten your fingers against your thumb,
right?
To like use those chopsticks because they're so flat. Anyway, I hold my chopsticks correctly because my mom taught me. My dad, I don't know about my dad. I think it was my mom. I didn't get a lot of shit for it, maybe because I happily got it like right the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I used to have a superiority complex about it that I'm not proud of.
Do you find yourself judging other Asians who don't hold them correctly?
I definitely notice. Which
Totally.
I'm like, were you raised by wolves? What the fuck are you doing? Jesus.
I think the if I were to give a pro tip, maybe for people who feel like they're not holding them correctly, I think the instinct is to hold them toward the middle.
Yes.
But actually, it's easier to hold them toward the end.
Mm-hmm.
The end meaning, like, far away from the food that you're trying to, like, pick up or whatever.
Since nobody can see you, this smells like a YouTube video to me.
Yeah.
I think you guys should do, like, a...
Yeah, well, I'm not even holding chopsticks right now. I'm just pinching the air. So, like, that would be my one... piece of advice, like
don't hold it where you would hold like a pencil or
like it would have to be higher up, like toward the eraser. Mm-hmm. It's just easier to like actually move the chopsticks with less effort. I think maybe there's like a learning curve to getting there, but yeah.
Do you guys know people that are bad with?
Yes.
Really? Yeah. White people, Asian people,
all Asian kinds. People, everyone. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are they generally clumsy, or it's just that one thing that they never got?
No, I think they just learn to use it in a way, like, they can still eat their food and, like, pick up their food, but they, I mean, there's something really, I don't know if it's, like, pan-Asian, but there's something really Japanese about the concept of the quote, right way to use chopsticks.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, like, honestly, like, if you can pick up your food and eat it without spilling it everywhere, like, you're probably using it the right way, but, like...
Sure.
I mean,
the standard, quote, also, quote, way to use it is different.
Right. It's like, yeah. I mean, have you seen the way people write? Sometimes with, like, a physical pen or pencil?
Sure.
It's, like, the same thing.
Okay. Just,
like, one time I saw someone ball up a fist, basically, and then, like, write
and
this way.
Pencil in it.
But they had beautiful handwriting, so I was just like, okay, maybe I just shouldn't judge the way that you're holding that pencil in the same way with... chopsticks.
Yeah.
Speaking of chopsticks, I can't eat salad with the fork and knife. Like, I have to use chopsticks.
I do that too.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh my gosh, they're so flat. You can't pierce that shit with a fork. You need a chopstick for that.
Oh, and it's absurd to cut leaves in half. Like, that shit is crazy to me.
No.
Chopsticks
what?
Is just, like, so easy.
Who cuts leaves in half?
You've never seen people eat salad with a fork and knife?
Maybe with a fork.
And
knife. Yeah.
Oof, no.
Because, you know, sometimes, like, the chef will put those big ass leaves in there. And
yeah, that makes sense. I just bite and break.
Kevin and I were visiting past guests Brian and Lisa in Boston, like,
my favorite guest.
A few months.
Brian, if you're listening, that was a great... There were so many points during that interview where I wanted to interject, but I was like, oh, wait, they can't hear you.
Awesome. Yeah. But I remember, like, we were just hanging out in their apartment, and then Brian just, like, tosses me a bag of chips, and then he, like, holds out a pair of chopsticks. I'm like, the fuck are you doing? And he's just like, oh, girl, you don't know. And I'm like, don't know what? And he's just like... You fucking eat you eat chips with chopsticks, man. It, like, prevents your fingers from getting grody.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how did I live for 30 years? 30 yeah. years and not know this. Like, so smart.
Sure.
Plus, if you're like eating like white cheddar popcorn,
Yeah.
Fuck, use chopsticks, man.
That's how you keep your keyboard spotless.
Yep. Oh my god. I've been living a mistake for so long. I also use a spoon sometimes. That also works.
A spoon for popcorn?
Yeah, for popcorn.
So it feels like you're eating savory cereal.
Yeah. That is kind of what it's like out of a bag, basically.
I don't know if because that would be such a disconnect, because it's like you've got the crunch, you've got the spoon, but then it's like salty.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not, there's no like milk in it, so it doesn't feel like you're eating.
But I mean, my taste buds would be primed for like, my brain would be going like, okay, sugar taste buds, get ready, here it comes. Oh, fuck, it's salty.
Oh, I don't really eat sweet cereal. My cereals are like really boring, like Cheerios and cornflakes.
You're so healthy and adult.
I don't know. I think it's been like that forever.
To me, cereal is Captain Crunch.
So good.
Cinnamon Toast Crunch.
Although that stuff will tear the roof of your mouth. Oh, it's like so abrasive. Right?
I have another how Asian are you question. Is like, how do you feel about fusion food?
I gotta say I'm for, because there used to be this restaurant called Juno's in the West Village that I loved, and it was French and Korean, and the chef just mixed it correctly. It was really, really good.
But what is correct? Like, what does it mean to do French and Korean correctly?
Like, he just figured out which flavor went right with which meat, like which things would go well together. Whereas if you go up to, I probably shouldn't name it by name, but there's a French Vietnamese place just up the block, and it's terrible. Like, the chef has just picked the wrong...
Flavor profiles.
Yeah, exactly. Flavor profiles. That's the word I was looking for. So, I mean, I think it can be well done, but the chef's got to be talented. It's just like a cocktail, right?
Right.
That's true. I am a general fan of fusion, but what I don't like is when people think that that is Asian food.
Right.
Oh, do people think that?
I think, in my mind, like, when I think of fusion, I don't necessarily think of something like French and Korean. I think of, like, a... Like, the idea of, like, maybe I'm thinking more of, like, pan-Asian American food.
Oh.
Like,
that's no good.
Like, the Thai and Vietnamese restaurant.
Those always crack me up.
And honestly, like, I love food, and I will probably eat it even if most people think it's, like, not that good. And I'll just be like, I don't mind this, like, if it tastes good. But what I don't like is the associations that people will have, like, oh, we're going to go to a Japanese restaurant, and then they're, like, putting grilled chicken in their udon, when I'm like, I don't know. It's just weird when I see stuff like that, and I'm like, it's good. It tastes good, but I'm just like, I feel feelings when you think that this is, like, what Japanese food is supposed to be.
Right. Sure. I feel like fusion food, like, the gourmet version of fusion food, all for it. I'm like, oh, cool, you're taking the best parts of, like, two completely different cultures.
Yeah, it's, like, really well thought out and considered.
And the... sushi restaurant that also serves
like fortune cookies and
fortune cookies and chow mein.
That's just lazy.
General Tso's chicken. You're like, come on, man.
Yeah.
That's just lazy.
I will say that I have a fondness for California rolls. It is like it's like a successful, in my mind, oh my God, Brayden is making a face.
No, it's
oh, okay. This is actually a good question. What is your guilty pleasure, like, fusion food or Americanized Asian food that you really like?
Oh, I don't think I have one.
You don't?
And it's really shameful, but we
no
didn't
Panda
grow up
Express?
Eating...
Oh,
no,
God, I love Panda Express. Holy shit.
Again, I didn't grow up eating Asian food.
Oh, like, that's really... true.
Okay. I have a Korean friend, my buddy Ed, and his parents were taking a trip to Spain, and he saw them packing, and they were putting jars of kimchi in the suitcase. He's like, what are you doing? They're like, we're going to be there for 2 weeks. We can't live without kimchi for 2 weeks. We're going to find it in Spain. And I told my parents, like, do Korean people do that? They're like, well, they do. We don't. It's like, we didn't really eat it growing up.
Huh.
Yeah, so sorry.
That is amazing.
That's totally cool.
That is amazing.
I think California rolls for me. I love lo mein. I know. It's shameful, but I love that shit. Holy. I mean, I'm not expecting to find that anywhere else outside of the United States. Mm-hmm. But
if you guys had to pick three cuisines, like you're stranded on a desert island, you could bring three chefs from three different cuisines, what would they be?
Japanese, hands down. I personally love Vietnamese food. I think it's fantastic. And then the third, probably Mexican food.
I love
Mexican food. Yeah.
All right.
Oh, this is so hard because I thought I had three, but then you said Mexican food and I was just like, oh, fuck, now it's four. I was going to say Japanese, Vietnamese, and Italian.
Oh,
yeah.
Italian food. I could live without pizza and pasta and that stuff. Like, I feel like everyone's go-to food when they're, like, lazy or drunk or... it's pizza. And I'm just like, that is not... I would rather have a banh mi.
Me too. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Picks are going to be Japanese, Italian, and French. So it seems like there's a clear winner.
We did it!
Japanese food!
Oh, but pizza. You grew up eating California pizza. And
yeah,
then...
I think it's just I didn't grow up eating. I don't. My understanding of what pizza is supposed to taste like is so different now.
Because
I have probably had more pizza in the last 4 years than the collective sum of my adult life. Okay.
What was your reaction the first time you tried a proper New York slice?
Oh, it's so good. Just like the thin crust and like actual cheese. And like, right. I think I grew up eating like, I mean, I just grew up eating chain pizza. So Papa John's,
CPK.
Yep. Got that barbecue chicken pizza. And then,
barbecue chicken pizza.
Yep. Oh my God, California I love pizza that shit. Kitchen.
That's another Asian, like, not Asian, but another fusion food that I'm like, I'm down. Like, people are like, that's not proper pizza. And I'm like, but it tastes good.
Should you guys ever go to Zippy's? And you guys ever been to Hawaii? That place is friggin' amazing.
Zippy's. What's Zippy's?
It's like a Denny's, but with Asian food also. Yes. So you can get like a bacon cheeseburger and then like dumplings. And they have like, it's a great drunk food spot.
Chili. Zippy's chili is dank.
Wow.
So good.
I have to go. One day.
You've never been to Hawaii?
No.
Wow. You gotta, it's like Asian paradise, man.
Yeah.
That's what
Talk about like pan-Asian, but it's like everything's done right.
Yeah. I was so upset when they finally figured out I wasn't a local. Because I had gotten the tan, but I was online at a store and the guy was like pigeoning me.
Oh.
And I was like, what? What? Like he said it like three times. He's like, do you want a bag? And he just said it in English. And I was like, fuck, my cover's blown. I do that in Chinatown, too, when they say the price. Mm-hmm. I'm always, like, looking at the register. Because they'll say it in Cantonese, and I look at the register to figure out how much to give them. Because I want them to think I'm Chinese. I don't know why.
Because you think they'll give you the deal.
A better deal, yeah.
Which
they
never do. Right? Yeah.
It's funny how, like, let's say you go to a restaurant that's, like, owned by a friend. And you're like, oh, my friend has a restaurant. It's going to be great. I'm going to get a deal when I get there. But when you go there, actually, you're just like... I think I'm actually going to end up paying a lot more money because I, like, kind of want you to succeed.
Right,
and
right,
maybe I'll get something for free if I'm lucky. But, like, that's just kind of how it works. Like, you want to tip better. You want to, like, help them out. And it's just counterintuitive from what you initially might imagine. Yeah. I don't know. That's kind of how it ends up for me.
Well, there's, like, two mentalities behind that, right? Which is, like, I'm going to overpay to make sure you succeed. Or it's, like, I expect to be treated for free.
Yeah. I'm definitely the former of that.
Yeah. I can't... Do you think... Most Asian people would be doing the former, right? I can't see many Asian people doing the latter.
Right,
yeah.
So I feel like we don't have that sense of self-entitlement. At least Asian Americans don't.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I'm mostly referring to, like, white people.
Why is self-entitlement so galling?
Yeah. Oh, God.
I think that was awesome.
Yeah, Rain, thank you so much for coming
on
the podcast.
Yeah.
Where can people find you on the internet? Do you want to be found?
I mean, you can try Facebooking Rain No. I probably am going to relaunch my old website for anybody that wants to follow my personal writings, hipstomp.com. But as that's not live right now, you should just look at Hipstomp on Twitter. I'm not active, but when I launch the website, I'll make the announcement there.
So, awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
This is awesome.
Hey, Kate. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on the internet at CMYKAYTOE, at CMYKATO. Yoko, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me at PSYOKO, at PSYOKO, on Twitter and Instagram.
PSYOKO. That is how it is accurately pronounced.
Yep, you heard it from the source. If you want to follow the podcast, we are at SWAYF Podcast. SWAYF podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Our website is swayfpodcast.com. Our email is swayfpodcast@gmail.com. Our SoundCloud is SWAYF Podcast. And that's it.
Yeah. Send us. Yeah.
Drop us a line.
Yes. Drop us a line and rate us on iTunes. Yay.
Only if it's 5 stars.
Oh, God.
But really, if it's 4 stars, can you just email us and tell us what we can do better?
Yeah, tell us what we can do better.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.